Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Caught Offside with Andrew Gunling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes! Caught offside from just outside of New York City and from an apartment in Brooklyn, New York, Andrew Gunling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother? How are you?
I'm good, Andrew. That was some weekend. That was some weekend of football.
Oh, aren't they all? Aren't they all?
They really are. There's so many good games right now. I say that. That's not true. Chelsea and Liverpool was really not worth getting up early on Saturday morning for. It was pretty bad. But I think Sunday redeemed all of that with an absolute throwback cracker between Arsenal and Manchester United. And we're recording this early in the morning, so I'm not just thinking about the games, Andrew. I'm also trying to figure out what Brian McBride did for the U.S. men's national team.
What a question. I actually do. So later in the podcast, we'll talk about that because I guess I have an answer. I don't know if it will satisfy you, but I do have the Athletic reported what his job description essentially was. So I can at least tell you that. All right. So stay tuned if you're also like JJ curious for what it was Brian McBride did for the U.S. men's national team.
There's a show called The Thick of It, which was about political satire in England. And at he's firing one of the ministers, this kind of spin doctor, almost Alistair Campbell style figure. And he just goes, "You did nothing. You were the epitome of political mist. You're there, but you're not really. And you don't do anything."
Wow. Scathing stuff from JJ Devaney. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. A couple U.S. Notes that and Gio Reyna scored an unbelievable goal over the weekend as the Bundesliga returned to action. We'll talk about that, or more so maybe his celebration to that goal. We'll get into it. Like you said, I know Liverpool-Chelsea, the result wasn't necessarily much, but we will talk a little bit about that. Some of the things, as this is an early Monday morning podcast, some of the things we're looking forward to this week as football is going on forever and ever. There's a lot of important matches coming up during the course of this week, which we'll get you ready for as well. But let's start, JJ, with the high-profile fixture that was Arsenal and Manchester United on Sunday at the Emirates in North London. And it was, I mean, there was a lot of hype leading into this one, and I would say it lived up to that billing. It's got to be one of the front runners right now for match of the season as we hit the halfway point.
100%. It had absolutely everything. It seemed relentless. It was frantic. There was goals. There was mistakes. And the fixture was relevant again, which has not been the case for many's the year. This felt real again.
So at the start of the game, Peter Drury, as he does, I mean, he's a wordsmith. He's a brilliant wordsmith, a poet of this sport, no question about it. And he kind of went into one of his poems.
Soliloquies, I believe they're called.
Sure, soliloquy, sure. Of what this of the great nostalgia of this fixture with these two teams, like you just said, seemingly both relevant again, and sort of, you know, just the joy of that. Take us through it a little bit, JJ. Be our historian here. Talk to us about the nostalgia of a big time Arsenal Manchester United fixture.
I mean, obviously, these are the two of the biggest clubs in English football. They had some great games in the 70s, and they had a brawl in 1990, which was famous. But they really came together as, when Peter Drury talks about nostalgia, it's for the Wenger-Ferguson period. So roughly 1997 until 2006, I would say. That because then Arsenal fell off significantly, I would say, after that, and the rivalry dwindled a little bit as Manchester United kind of focused on Chelsea, and then latterly, Manchester City became a powerhouse. But this game was the game. It was the game you looked at on the calendar. It had, for a period of years, something happened in every single game, whether it was Keane versus Vieira in the tunnel, Vieira versus Neville, Fergie versus Ashley Cole, and pizza and soup thrown around. There was the famous Martin Keown versus Van Nistelrooy incident, where Van Nistelrooy misses a late penalty to win the game, and then Keown just like jumps into him and into his face, and they almost bully Van Nistelrooy off the field. This fixture had the whiff of sulfur all the time, and then it went away, because really Arsenal went into decline, and then United went into their own decline. So we'll say from 2013 to this Sunday, that was not a game. You were like, it was fine. You'd watch it if you supported the clubs, but it wasn't the appointment TV viewing that it was in the late 90s into the early 2000s. I mean, that was the fixture. And so it's great to have that back.
Yeah. So if you take a look at it from basically when Wenger's tenure begins until Ferguson's tenure ends. So if we go from 96, 97, when Wenger joined up with Arsenal, and up through 12-13 when Ferguson leaves Manchester United, if you look at that, it's 17 seasons. One of those two teams finished first. It was usually Manchester United, but one of those two finished first 13 out of those 17 seasons, which is outstanding. Now, the real period that you and Peter Drury are referring to, 97-98 through 02-03.
Yeah.
When, of those, how many years is that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Of those 7 years, of those 6 years, in five of them, United and Arsenal finished first and second. That's the window where they owned this sport, essentially. They owned, or certainly this league.
Think some of the goals in the game. Like, you had Henry's turn and volley into the top corner against Barthez at Highbury. You had brilliant, brilliant matches. And even the nil-nils. There was a nil-nil at Old Trafford that I went out to watch, I remember, with my father. And it was frantic. At the end of it, it's like you've been in a wind tunnel. It was like there were tackles crashing in, and they hated each other. They openly said it. We hated them. And there was a documentary, you can find it on YouTube, called that ITV did. And I think it was called Keane versus Vieira, or Vieira versus Keane, about that period. And Keane used to say that in the lead up to the game, the week of the game, his body would get sore. He could feel his body getting sore, getting ready for the hard tackles that would be put in this game. It was truly the biggest fixture in English football for a few years there, and the two best teams. And then it wasn't for a long, long time. But it felt, it'll never quite be, get back to that point, because of Wenger and Ferguson, the characters involved, Arteta and Ten Hag, are just not going to be like that. Although Arteta is doing a pretty good job on the sideline of,
we'll see.
We'll see, exactly.
It'll never be the same, but it can, but it's still, you know, who knows what kind of period we're entering into.
But that was great yesterday. That was really great.
Yeah. And look, it's obviously we're in a Manchester City universe right now, where other teams will certainly enter the conversation as to being the contenders of this league. But like, it will be hard for any two teams to sort of solely control this league without one of those two being Manchester City. Just that's sort of just the nature of the beast right now. And Newcastle are hot on their heels, and the way Chelsea are spent, it just feels, I don't know, like, I guess you could look at, you know, whatever nostalgia you view Arsenal and Manchester United in from that period of time. Maybe in 20 years time, it's what we'll say about what this era was between Liverpool and Manchester City. You know, rivals that aren't necessarily geographical rivals or historical rivals, but became rivals during a set era because of just how great they were and how dominant they were over the rest of the league. I mean, JJ, during that period of time, if you listed the top 10 players in the Premier League, how many do you think came from one of those two teams? It was probably like 7-8 of the list were off of those two sides.
And a smattering at Chelsea and a smattering at Liverpool, I suppose. But otherwise, it was all from those two teams. And again, the whole league watched it. You know, who was going to win the title this year? There was going to be two teams in the running. What incident would happen? What late challenge? What red card? What brilliant goal? And like I said, it really felt... Yeah, the nostalgia was real. The game fitted the billing. You know, and I was at the Black Horse in Brooklyn, where you'd have both Arsenal and Manchester United supporters in there, and it meant something to them too. You could feel it. The result as well is huge for Arsenal. It's absolutely huge. You can see that Arsenal are further along in their development than Manchester United are at this point under Erik ten Hag, which is totally to be expected. And Arsenal. You just have to give Arteta so much credit, and I have to give you credit.
Oh,
you called this. You said after the documentary, which I found, you know, parts of it kind of risible and funny. You said, "Nah, man, there's something about him. His players will play for him," and you just cannot understate how that is the case. It is absolutely the case. Arteta has got this young team together. I think it's crucial that they're young. I really do. I think Arsenal went through that period of, first of all, it was very hard for them to get top players. They were out of the Champions League, so they'd end up with your Willians and your David Luises and all this. And it was, guys in their 30s, just, it wasn't right. Even Aubameyang towards the end, it wasn't working. And the focus on and the patience with the younger players, with the Nketias, with the Martinellis, the Sakas, just so important, because you can mold those players. You can get them to do what you want. You can get them to take instruction in a way you can't with a grizzled old veteran who's heard it all before. And now they are reaping the rewards. It's what Arsenal have done is it's a real examination in patience, and how patience in football is probably a good idea.
Yeah, although some of their fans might tell you that they had to wait longer for this than they would have expected. Not necessarily. I mean, look, they haven't won anything yet, but I just mean in terms of being a true part of a title race.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing to win one, but to at least have been a part of one. Arsenal have waited a while to even be a part of one. And that's something that they're not necessarily accustomed to. So yes, in the end, that patience will have paid off, but I don't know that this went exactly according to plan. They had to try a lot of plans before they got to this.
They
plan.
Did. But weirdly, they were kind of forced into this, weren't they? Like, they didn't have the money to compete with City. They didn't have the money to compete with Liverpool. Players didn't want to go to them. So they were forced to be creative and to do it the old school way. And so far, so good. I feel weird because I still look at that squad and think, oh man, I know they've got Trossard in now and that, but you just don't want injuries. They cannot afford injuries. But, If you're not excited about Arsenal as an Arsenal supporter right now, these are rare times for them.
Yeah, it's remarkable. As for this game specifically, look, it was a fascinating game before Eddie Nketiah's winner. It was probably one of the matches of the season. But then a game that had lived up to the hype in that way received an ending befitting of the hype that it was given. The 90th minute winner from Nketiah, a really interesting creative goal where he sort of just has to throw his foot at the ball at a difficult angle to get it past De Gea. It was an incredible moment. What a release of joy from that stadium as well. Arsenal now, JJ, become just the fifth team to reach 50 points at the halfway mark of a 38-game Premier League season. And the only one of those previous four who have done it to not win the title, do you know who that was?
Newcastle United?
No.
Oh.
It was actually Liverpool in 2018-19.
Oh, yeah.
When they finished on 98 points, yeah. City with 99. Just ridiculous.
It's
ridiculous
stuff. It is crazy. And when we're reflecting on periods, I do think we look back at that 4 or 5 year gap between with City and Liverpool, and we'd be like, what was going on there?
I know. The point, you're right. Like, as I was going through to look at the Arsenal United history, so I just kind of went year by year in the Premier League to just like re-examine where their finishes were and all that. And so I stopped with Ferguson, but I was like, I'm doing this. Let me just keep going. And the way you see the point totals rise over the latter half, like the end of this era, basically the last several years, it's like, it's comical almost to see just like, you know, where what those two teams have been doing, as opposed to like, you know, how easily Liverpool would have been winning the league in other years. And in this time, it's just not the reality of things with a beast like Manchester City. From this game, JJ, I mean, if we're talking about big moments, heroes, villains, stuff like that, I mean, the first name, I've already said it, Eddie Nketiah. It's an incredible story. And, you know, it's funny, a couple months ago, I don't know, whenever it was that Gabriel Jesus first got hurt, and Nketiah, he had come in, he played well right out of the gate. I think he scored in his first start after the Jesus injury. And I remember saying, I kind of jumped to a quick conclusion after that, during that pod. And I said something to the effect of, you know, it's just this train just keeps rolling along. Like, Jesus goes out and they don't have to worry about it because Eddie Nketiah steps in. And I remember thinking after I said it, Arsenal fans might cringe at that. They might think like this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Like, you've seen Nketiah score once now this season, and like, you're ready to say that they're fine without Jesus. And I thought about that afterwards. I said, maybe I went too far, but here we are. Like, here we are, and it hasn't let up. He's a huge reason. He's not just some stopgap to kind of fill in while Jesus gets healthy. He's reached a point now where I don't know how you drop him.
No.
I mean, like, he's playing to that level. The only other player to score a 90th minute winner for United in the Premier League against Manchester United was Henry in 2007, and Nketiah is now a part of that list. And it's funny because, like, I say, you know, I'm not saying any of this to cast aspersions on the faith that Arsenal supporters had in Nketiah. Arteta himself said after this game that they didn't see this coming with this guy, and it's just an amazing lesson, essentially. In this idea of, you never quite know how a player is going to respond when the moment is handed to them and they don't have to be looking over their shoulder anytime they do something wrong. I mean, some guys need the competition. They need to be fueled by the fact that there's someone behind them who could be getting their spot. And you know, for a lot of guys, that's everything. But for some guys, it might just be, this is mine now. I have the freedom and the space to kind of just play and not have to worry. And for some guys, the result is this. It's what you're seeing right now with him.
It's crazy too, because there were conversations about, oh, well, Nketiah is probably going to have to move on if he wants to get football. He'll probably have to leave. You know, he's a young player. He needs to play. And it's just really worked out for him right now. And Arsenal have been able to lean on those goals in a way that, I mean, it's been vital for them. Absolutely vital. And he is undroppable. It really is an amazing story. That goal as well, and I think you alluded to it, it's a brilliant finish. It's an brilliantly improvised finish. Because how many times do we see someone not get enough of a connection on that and it just dribbles to the goalkeeper? Or, you know, it's just a flash of the studs and you're like, oh, man, he couldn't quite adjust his body, but he could, and he found the net. There were some really good goals in this game, actually.
Yeah, there were. I mean, that was obviously the one that will forever be remembered. He scored. It was his second of the game. He scored Arsenal's first as well to equalize. But I think if I was actually listing the best goals from this game, it probably wouldn't have been an Arsenal goal, JJ. I think for me, I would have gone with the goal that started the scoring. Rashford, another player who's just in Eddie Nketiah like form right now. The goal that he scored to begin this was just, I mean, it's just the kind of goal that you get from a guy who's in that kind of form, dribbling past defenders, but still being over 20 plus yards from goal and just smashing one past the keeper the way that he did. It was incredible.
Yeah, and I do think if there was a, I wouldn't like to just say there's a quintessential kind of Rashford goal, but like he does like to drive the ball through the back of the ball, you know, get that kind of dip, that knuckle on the ball, and was a great strike. In terms of the long range efforts, then Saka's goal was a great strike too, but I didn't love Lisandro Martinez on it, and I know Eriksen kind of shepherds him inside, he does what he can, but the fact no one closes him, no one gets in there and kind of. It's
Eriksen.
Go on.
Yeah, like your point on Eriksen, I get in the aftermath of it all, but like it was one of those goals where you screamed when it went in because it was just like,
yeah,
I don't know. There was just from that distance, from that angle, yeah, he shepherded him inside. Maybe in hindsight, he shouldn't have done that. Saka obviously has this in his bag, but I was just like, whoa,
yeah.
Like who? Who saw that coming? Like, I couldn't believe that he scored from that position.
I do think as well, David De Gea, he's made an action, a kind of a jump to trying to be ready. And it's cost him a bit and he's slow to get down into the corner for it. But no, it was a great strike too. It was really, and if we're talking about, I did talk about mistakes earlier in the goals. I thought Ramsdale on the Lisandro Martinez goal was problematic there. I mean, I think like if goalkeepers come, you have to get something on it. You've got to get it away. It can't just drop like that. And I actually thought Martinez did very well to stay alive and get that ball into the net. But yeah, Ramsdale wouldn't have been, I'd say he was delighted, obviously delighted when they scored the late winner because it took a little bit of pressure off him for that goal.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Just back to, you know, if we're kind of looking at some of the heroes of this game, you know, we've talked a lot about Nketiah, but back to Saka for a sec, because I think he's kind of, I don't know, JJ, tell me if you agree, but if you had to assign a face to this Arsenal team, I suppose it would be his.
Yes.
And just the performance from him in this game, which up to this point in the season, you could say this was Arsenal's biggest match so far, maybe the Spurs one before it, just the nature of that rivalry, but where these two teams are at, the form they were in, and Saka rising to a man of the match level occasion the way that he did. 13 touches in the opponent box, always a threat. 4 chances created, 5 shots. Of course, one of the goals of the season for Arsenal so far. He's a menace to go against. He's kind of now, I think he's joined the elite in this league. If we're, you know, we've hit the halfway point, I guess we could start to think about now our 11 of the season, what it would be for the first half of the season. He's on it. He's certainly in it right now.
Oh, absolutely. And again, just there was so much potential there, and we've kind of see it in little drips and drabs over the last few seasons. And now people wondered what would happen to him after the missed penalty in the Euros. You know, like this is the kind of moment where it can define a player, and for it to happen to him so young, but he's really just taken everything in stride, and he's been absolutely brilliant for Arsenal. In terms of heroes though, that midfield of Odegaard, Partey and Xhaka, I mean, if you had asked me, will there be an Arsenal title challenge that features Granit Xhaka, I would have said probably not. If you asked me about the great issue that Arsenal have had probably since early Wenger, which was centre-backs. Like, would they find a solution and it'd be Saliba and Gabriel? Like, they've a lot of guys really playing outstanding football at the moment outside of the attacking players as well.
Yeah, you're right. It's one of the things that's interesting about this team is like, it's not like they splashed on some huge name signing to sort of kickstart this. Like it was guys that, like you said, they were either patient with, you know, guys where the recruitment was just right, guys who have sort of progressed in just the right way from, you know, within Arsenal's own ranks. You see that. You see that all over the place for them. That's really what this team is comprised of, which is a little bit frightening because you think that they will, it's not going to take much for them to then quickly once again become a destination club for big names.
Well, we've seen it already. I mean, the fact that they were, I do think there was some kind of economic factors that meant Mudryk did not end up there, but it was his preferred destination. You know, a top talent in Europe that wants to go to Arsenal, if you're winning and you're top of the table, that's naturally going to follow. But like Saliba on loan last season, you know, great decision to recall him and have him there and not, you know, try and move on from him. Because I remember, again, you read all the transfer rumors. He was one that was nearly going to be out the door. But it's been some great coaching from Arteta.
Yeah. Now, on the United side of this, I mean, we've gone through some of the heroes, which have all been Arsenal players, with the exception of Rashford. Some of the villains here, I mean, I'll throw in the first one. It's one that didn't play. Boy, there were moments in this game where I was just thinking about, ooh, that Casemiro yellow card just looks a lot bigger right now. That they could have used a player like that to sort of bust things up in the midfield. But
I agree with you. And I think we're at the point under Ten Hag now where you can see the limitations of some of the players he has. And you're thinking, on this next path for United, this next stretch of miles, as they try to, you know, do what everyone thinks they're going to do, which is United are back, you see some players that are not going to be on that journey. And I think guys like McTominay are probably, and probably the goalkeeper too, they won't be there.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. And then another name, Aaron Wan-Bissaka. I don't know. He'd come back into the lineup. He was playing fairly well, but then in this game, he fell back on some things that I think have driven United fans crazy about him, falling asleep at the back post on the first goal. Roy Keane said this about him. He said it's just his lack of awareness. It's as if he can't believe someone's coming around the back of him.
Yeah.
Because he can see him, he just dozes off. A silly lack of concentration, considering we praise him, saying he's a good defender. I mean, stuff like that, like you say, JJ, if they're back, those aren't the sort of things that you see from teams that are back. Guys falling asleep like that in a big moment, in a dangerous spot on the field, losing sight of an attacker. Can't happen.
It reminds me of one of, you know, there's some fan listener interactions you have and they stick with you. The email where I said at the start that I didn't think Wan-Bissaka was good enough for United. And this United fan just emailed me and said, "You're wrong. He's a brilliant player." But Bissaka was symptomatic of a kind of a scattergun approach to transfers. Like he was the soup du jour at Crystal Palace. And so they went, "All right, we'll put all this money into him," without actually thinking about, well, what will he do off the ball? What will he do when we're in possession? Structurally, how will this work? And it hasn't really worked. And you're right. He's going to be one of those guys that will not be fellow travelers with Ten Hag going forward, you would think.
Feels like that. To close out on this section and on this game, back to Arsenal. We'll finish with them. Look, there's a lot of reasons to be surprised by what they're doing this season, by their position at the table, by the fact that they're only the fifth team in the Premier League era to hit 50 points halfway through. It's just an incredible thing that this team has been capable of doing that. So of the surprises of this team, I'm wondering, what are some that stand out to you most?
I think I'm surprised at how defensively robust they are. That is because we've just, what we used to say, I mean, the word that was associated with Arsenal all the time was brittle. Always. I think yesterday, going a goal behind, having been equalized on, and then being able to continue to play and keep patience with their style of play, not to lose the rag, and to just keep doing the right things and go and win the game. That has just not been a hallmark of Arsenal teams. And now it is. I would also say, I thought a few years ago that Martin Odegaard was going to just kind of slip into this because of the way he started his career as a young player. You know, all the hype. One of those guys where you'd be, remember him? Oh yeah, everyone said he was going to be this, he was going to be that. I'm surprised. I never thought he'd be a kingpin or an important player at the top side that's in challenging for the title. I just thought he'd be a guy we remembered who started really young and then kind of fizzled out. And I think he's been great for Arsenal, and that surprised me.
Yeah. So there they go. They remain top. They remain with the cushion between them and their next challengers, which are, of course, Manchester City, who keep pace with an important win over the weekend of their own, 3-0 over Wolves. So they remain in this thing, certainly. What do you think? The type of performance that shows maybe they receive Pep's message?
Hard to say, especially considering the opposition and their position in the table. But the kind of win you want, you know, basically for Man City now, they have to start doing what they've become accustomed to down the stretch, ripping off those wins. And this is one of those.
We know they can do it.
You know they can do it. Don't leave it in any doubt. Just go out there and destroy. And I suppose in terms of that performance, you know, I mean, they allowed Wolves have one shot on target in the entire game. I still wonder about them a little bit in terms of, are they quite the City of old in terms, you know, chance creation, things like that. But I mean, this game was all them. And you're right. It's the kind of performance they just have to do, build up the momentum and try and eat into that Arsenal. They're in the rare situation for City where they are looking for favors. That is one thing. But as long as they keep doing their job, they'll...
What do you mean? What do you mean by that?
Well, they need Arsenal to slip up.
Oh, okay.
They need a favor along
well,
the way.
Well, I mean, they play them twice. They still have two games against them. So they kind of control it a little bit.
They do a little bit. And that will be there for Arsenal. And as big a game as that was yesterday, and it was a big game and a big win for Arsenal, there's a good chance the league does come down to those two meetings.
Yeah, the other thing I wanted to mention with this one, obviously Erling Haaland, the story of this match, hat trick for him, incredible. Another one. This is his fourth of the season. Just like ridiculous stuff. And I referenced this the other day that it is not just a creation in my mind. He had a couple matches, I guess, or was it even a couple? Was it just one where he didn't really seem to make the kind of impact on the game that we had seen from him in so many other games this season? And I'm telling you, like, I'm not making it up. You start to immediately see questions and doubts being raised about him. And so, you know, the moment I start to think, maybe that was sort of in my head, I saw this written at Sky Sports from Adam Bate. He said, Pep Guardiola made the point that when Haaland scores, everyone says that he's the solution. And when he does not score, everyone says that he's the problem. That is likely to be how it continues for the striker until and unless he fires City to trophies at the end of the season. On Sunday, he was the solution. Pep sees it too. Any game where he doesn't score, he becomes the problem. I don't quite know what the genesis of this is. I don't know why people are drawn to do this with him when he's been so great. If the season ends today, he'd be player of the season. I guess maybe Saka would be runner-up, but to me, the gap between first and second in that would be pretty significant. He's going to shatter the Premier League's goal-scoring mark, and he's going to do so probably in March of the season. I don't know. Is it because we're just not accustomed to seeing a player like this at this club? So for some reason, there are people who early on didn't think it could work, and so they can't wait to kind of jump back and say, see, I was right at every moment where it doesn't go according to plan for City and Pep. I don't understand it, why people seem to have kind of tagged this as a thing that they want to see fail.
Well, the preconceived notion was that this can't work because Pep has an aversion to strikers. He doesn't believe in them. He doesn't necessarily think that they're needed. And the other thing is that Haaland wants that earlier ball. When he's off the shoulder and he's gone, he wants that ball played. And we know City like to play an extra pass or two extra passes because Pep believes that early ball, if it's cut out, then a team breaks on you and it's chaos and they'll score. And he doesn't want that. So it's more stylistically, can this work? Now, it obviously can work. If you have him in the right position getting on the end of these moves, it's of course it's going to work. It's just that it changes. There was a belief that it would change the way City play. And so when he doesn't score, Andrew, and City don't win, that's the focus. And there was times where you're like, they're not passing him the ball. He's not really involved at all. And I think it's more to do with what Pep wants and Pep's idea of just having a team of midfielders, you know.
Are we sure that Pep, as how did you put it, has an aversion to strikers? Are we sure of that? Like, he had Aguero for an era, so he didn't have to really worry about it. Then Aguero sort of transitioned out of being that guy. They thought maybe Gabriel Jesus was the heir apparent. They found out that he wasn't. And then what happened after that? Okay, they didn't have one, but it wasn't for lack of trying. They wanted Kane. They were desperate for Harry Kane, but Tottenham wouldn't deal with them. So I don't know. And then they go and get Haaland. So I don't know that I can say he has an aversion to them. I think he doesn't have an aversion to the best ones.
I'm just saying that was more of the thought that was going around, and that has prompted people to focus on Haaland when things aren't going right. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm sure Pep looks at it in a much more cerebral fashion than I'm even explaining. I'm sure if I said that to Pep, he'd just go, "What are you talking about?" You know, he probably sees it in a totally different way. It's probably not just here's a striker, here's a midfielder for him. He probably sees it on a completely different plane of understanding. So,
right, it's the meme of Zach Galifianakis in The Hangover when he's counting cards at the blackjack table.
Yeah, like, and pie comes up.
Yeah. That's Pep looking out at the field.
Basically, yeah, he's processing it in a way that my tiny footballing brain cannot understand.
Correct.
But that was the prevailing thought amongst fans and some journalists when Haaland was bought. And there's also a feeling as well that, well, who bought Haaland? Was it Pep? Was it Ferran Soriano? Was it the club? Did the club want the biggest striker in the world for other reasons than putting the ball in the net? Well, obviously putting ball in the net, but just to have the best players in the world at the club. Was that part of it too? You don't know.
Yeah, I can't imagine them going to, let's say it wasn't a Pep signing specifically. I can't imagine them saying to Pep, "Hey, we're about to bring in arguably the best striker in the world," and him saying, no, I'm good. Like, I think maybe another guy suggested it, but I don't think Pep would put up any resistance to Erling Haaland being brought there, especially on a fairly reasonable price tag, considering what other guys go for. So City, they keep pace. It's going to be a fight to the finish. I don't see City fading away. I think this is going to be relentless. And like we said, they got two matches against each other. Those are going to be absolute battles. Should be fun. Another matchup that in the past, I think we would look at and say absolute battles. They've had big Champions League ties against each other. They've, you know, they've battled for titles or title contenders in most seasons. But this was JJ, a very rare mid-table meeting between Chelsea and Liverpool.
Yeah. And I hope it stays very rare, because it was dull. It was really, really bad. I thought Chelsea had the better of it probably in the first half.
I think it would have helped this game a lot had that goal that Chelsea scored in the third minute, had that stood. I think it would have dramatically altered the complexion of this game.
I mean, the best thing was when Mudryk came on and you kind of saw what I see in him, maybe not what the stats guys see, but I thought he was great when he came on. I mean, that is a reason for Chelsea to be excited. I think it's, you know, it's probably a decent point for both teams, you know, just a steadying result. Nobody wants to lose that one. I know you're making faces at me now.
But they need points. Like, a tie doesn't really help anyone, though.
I know they do. For me, like, watching Gakpo, I just don't, I know it's early, but it's hard to see how he fits in there. Nunez comes off the bench. He has a chance where he turns and he fires it straight at the keeper. And, you know, Liverpool they shuffled the pack a little bit. Bacic played.
Trent didn't start.
No, it did. None of it clicked, Andrew. Like, at halftime, I was just like, oh, can we just call this game off? Everyone gets a point.
Well, just you got your wish.
Go home early. You know, it was really poor, really, really poor.
Can I ask you kind of a dire question?
You may.
So we're getting, it's a 10th versus 9th, Chelsea versus Liverpool, in terms of where they are. Both clubs are in a worrisome state. Which one of these states do you think is more worrisome?
Ooh. I maybe it's just because it's me, but I kind of feel Liverpool.
Okay.
I feel like we're at the end of something, and the worry is whether Klopp now can go again and rebuild a second side. And a lot of people say he didn't really do that at Dortmund. He hasn't done that anywhere. Can he build a second great Liverpool team and finish out with that? And that worries me a lot. With Potter, I do think they're going to give him the time. I mean, that squad's a bit of a mess. Like, they have 72 attacking players, which Potter is going to have to somehow blend into talk about an embarrassment of riches. They're not all riches. Some of them are just not working. So I suppose there's reason for concern there.
Yeah, you said something before, because when I put this question on the rundown, and I'll be honest, I put it down without having an answer, which is I'm a coward, I'm weak, I'm soft, I'm all of these things, which it's why I asked you, because I was wondering if you could sway me, because you know I've been not ready to, what's Mark Twain's quote about death?
Rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated.
Right.
Rumors of my demise.
Yeah, you know that's sort of the way that I feel about Liverpool. That, okay, maybe this season will be a step back. That's definitive. We see it. I don't think anything is going to happen between now and the end of the year that's going to change that. But I'm not ready to pronounce this era over. I don't know. I just not there yet. But you said something before in reference to post-Fergie United that I'm thinking about right now. And maybe you're helping me answer this question with regards to how I feel about Chelsea. You said that before when we were talking about United, their approach to transfers became very scattergun. And it just didn't work for years. Boy, I think you could look at some of Chelsea's moves over the last year and say a similar thing. That it just feels like they're just grabbing names.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's a plan. They've changed managers. I don't know how many of these signings were signings that the manager would have wanted. I don't know. Maybe that can work, but if it does, it feels like it's a little bit out of luck that the pieces wind up fitting.
We had a window into this, though. Don't forget that they didn't really have a sporting director. They had Todd. Todd Bowley was doing a lot of this, and Todd was the one bringing names. You know, he kept saying Cristiano Ronaldo in front of Thomas Tuchel, which drove Thomas Tuchel to insanity. So there is a sense that Chelsea were doing exactly what you were saying. They were seeing the big names and like, well, can we get that player? Can we get them in? Rather than thinking, well, how does he fit into the structure of what we want? Like, what's the vision for the club now? And it's very hard to see it at the moment. I mean, they're just like even Cucurella is a very curious transfer. You know, he'll probably get better, but it hasn't been a great start.
Now, look, the one thing that has to be said about Chelsea is that what's on the field right now isn't necessarily who they are. Like, you know, they are missing, you know,
but like Aubameyang, like what was that about?
Agreed. Totally agree. But, you know, no Reece James, no Ben Chilwell, no N'Golo Kanté for almost the entire season. I mean, if you talk about the importance of him to that team. So
you'd have to say they're probably 20 points better off if N'Golo Kanté is a regular in the midfield.
That number might be high, but he's obviously vital. I mean, I think Reece James might be their best player.
Yeah.
So having lost him for basically the entirety of the season, up to this point. So it's hard to judge them exactly. Maybe it will all fit. Although when all these guys come back, good Lord, then again, good problem, I suppose, for a manager to have a lot of good players to choose from. But it is still potentially a problem to keep everybody in that room happy. So I don't know. They've made a lot of big moves. The Mudryk, his first appearance was a positive one, I thought. Nearly scored an incredible goal, kind of weaving through the Liverpool defense. But yeah, I don't know. I guess
this is this is far too much time on this game. Let me just tell you. I know we're talking around the game because nothing happened in the game. But yeah, we're giving these two loser clubs.
Wow.
We're giving them way too much time.
All right. Well, then let's go to a winning club with an Everton.
Oh, dear. Oh, God. Did you see the video pre-game?
Yeah, Lampard.
Meeting people. It reminded me of
who were those people exactly?
They're supporters. They were.
How do they wind up with him? Is this just a thing now that happens? It's Yerry Mina. It's Anthony Gordon. It's the manager. Where? I thought this stuff didn't happen anymore.
No. I thought they were cosseted by you know security guards, and there was a ring of steel around them at all times. But I guess it looked like it was in a hotel. In London, so I guess the team hotel or the lobby or somewhere where Frank and they're just kind of saying to Lampard, "Oh Frank, yeah, you know, everyone's got your back. Just you know, go out and give it everything." And he's like, "Yeah, yeah," terrified.
I don't think he blinked once during the entire interaction.
Didn't, and I mean the people were being very kind to him. None of these, I will say this, none of those confrontations have been really nasty. They've been, if
impassioned.
Anything, they've been impassioned, but they've been mostly kind. The Everton fans have been mostly kind. And there's a part to me that is very much, we cannot be at a point in football where a manager running into fans or a player running into fans in the ordinary world should be seen as this bad, awful thing. How have we let this happen? That they'd be seen by regular people with jobs, people who maybe only earn 35,000 a year. How can this situation have come to pass? Like I do think there's a, I find it weird. I think people need to, these are humans talking to other humans, you know. But Frank did not see it that way.
But
I think
you're right. But I just find it weird that, I mean, that happened right before morning of the match, right?
Yeah, but like if they know where they, like those are traveling supporters.
Yeah.
And they, I guess they know they're in the area, they know where the team hotel is, and they, let's be honest, Everton supporters are now in the same frame of mind they were last April, Andrew. They are fully sure that barring some kind of miracle, their team is going down. So they can't, they're, remember all the, they kind of did this every time, and I think Ped from Toffee TV talked about this on Friday's podcast, where, you know, they'd all show up before a game with the flares, they'd welcome the bus into the stadium. They're doing whatever they can, and if that means meeting Frank Lampard at his hotel, they'll do it.
Well, they did, and Frank, I wouldn't say that he didn't seem scared. Like, I don't want to paint it like that.
I think he looked terrified, yeah.
I think he just looked like, in his head, he's thinking the whole time, like, don't say the wrong thing. Don't say the wrong thing. Be polite. Yeah. Don't say the wrong thing. Like, it's just kind of what it looked like. I don't know that he was even hearing them. He might have just been hearing his own inner monologue during that interaction. You mentioned Ped. For anybody who out there who didn't listen to our podcast, when was it? Late last week, last Thursday, Friday?
Friday morning.
Yeah, we did an In the Club with Ped from Toffee TV. It was really good. If you're an Everton supporter, it's a must listen, I would say. Even if you're not, it's an interesting glimpse at where an Everton fan is with this team right now. And the one thing that he said that really stuck out to me is, you know, his realization coming into the season of where are the goals going to come from?
Yeah.
Who are the guys on this team? And he's right. We earmarked that as well. And JJ, they've scored 15 goals in 20 games.
Oh,
like,
God.
Whatever the prophecy was that this team doesn't have goal scorers, like, they have not received the kind of surprise that Arsenal have with Eddie Nketiah. No one has stepped up. The player that people thought might in Anthony Gordon has not. It will forever remain a mystery to me how his price tag and how his valuation prior to the season rose to the level that it did. And even more of a mystery is how Everton decided to hang on to him with his price tag rising to that level. I don't know. Maybe they thought he was ready to become that guy, but he's not. Calvert-Lewin just can't quite stay healthy. And even when he is he an elite goal scorer? Not to me. I don't see it. I don't see it changing. They're going to have to win a lot of 1-0s to make this work. They got shut out again over the weekend by West Ham, who have been poor in their own right. They've only scored 17 goals this season, only a couple more than Everton. So it's not like they've been tearing it up either. It's just Everton, I don't know who the teams are out there that they're going to be beating to get back into this thing.
If you looked at West Ham Twitter after the game, like nothing changed for them. They expected to win because Everton were so poor. And Lampard made a lot about the fact, well, we had 60-something percent of the possession. We kept the ball, and then they looked to catch us on the break. I mean, what did you think West Ham were going to do? They know you can't do anything with the ball, so they'll just let you have it and then pick you off, and that's exactly what happened. And Everton, they had that one ball to the back post, and I think it was trying to stretch and get a foot on it. But generally speaking, Andrew, they couldn't create anything, never mind, oh, there's nobody to finish the chances. Didn't create anything. Now, Lampard said in his post-match comments how vital it is that the club step up and bring players in. Now, there's talk of Dan Juma joining. These next couple of weeks, Andrew, are vital. Because the only way out of this is to pull some rabbits out of hats in terms of signings. Because that squad itself is going down. So what can they get done? What can they change? Who can they bring in? Who can they convince to come for 4 or 5 months? I'm even talking loans, whatever. Oh, sure. Because Ped did talk about the financial state of things too. But they need something, any kind of spark. This is truly, truly dire. And they are so bad, so bad.
Yeah. Anything else from the weekend that you wanted to mention here before we move on?
I just want to say that Matoma is an amazing player, and his goal for Brighton was absolutely class. Have we been sleeping on him, as the kids say? He's brilliant, Andrew. He's absolutely brilliant, and he's Brighton. You just want to tune in and watch them. And Evan Ferguson again, talking about Irish players scoring in the Premier League. We talked a few weeks back on the Mailbag podcast about what's wrong with Irish soccer, and to see Evan Ferguson doing what he's doing right now, that header to save a point against Leicester, just brilliant. Brighton, they have been for under Potter, De Zerbi too. They're just great to watch. They're so much fun.
Yeah. 2-2. They would have liked to have, I'm sure, beaten a Leicester City side who aren't that great right now. But it's a point that kind of keeps them sort of in the background of a race for top four. Newcastle dropping points, JJ. I mean,
yeah,
against Crystal Palace, they tie 0-0, but it's an important couple points dropped for a team that's going to be fighting for top four for the remainder of the season as well.
Yeah, and it's a good result for Crystal Palace, I think, because they wanted to, after taking having a good result against United, they wanted to kind of keep that going and try and find some stability, and that was a good performance, or it's a good point against Newcastle as well. A lot of journalists saying Newcastle look jaded, and maybe we're seeing the squad being stretched. So be interesting to see if they have the capability with financial fair play to make any moves before the end of the window.
We'll see. Let's see a few other things that we want to mention before getting out here on this Monday morning. So the Bundesliga returned to action. Borussia Dortmund, a thrilling 4-3 win. They get a late winner from Gio Reyna. JJ, what a goal he scored. And, you know, it's interesting because only a few months ago, if he scores that same goal, my feelings about it, I can't help it. They're different than how I felt. I'm still like, everyone who has the stink of like the whole Reyna Bearhalter mess attached to them, which obviously Gio does, it's just hard for me to like get excited about that guy right now. And so I don't know, just I couldn't get quite as excited about that goal as I would have, you know, just before all this had happened. I still kind of look at him. I'm still in that moment where I kind of look at him a little bit differently. Having said that, it was a great goal, and American fans should look at it and be excited about what he can do. Now, the thing that I wanted to talk about with it wasn't the goal itself. It was the celebration afterwards.
Yes.
So he scores the goal, and he runs to the corner, and he's got his fingers in his ears, and he's doing the Memphis Depay celebration, which is not a coincidence after you remember Greg Berhalter noting that the U.S. doesn't have players scoring goals in the Champions League like Memphis Depay. That was the quote that he had said. Obviously, you know, U.S. soccer Twitter had a lot of thoughts on it. U.S. soccer Twitter tends to lean very strongly anti-Berhalter. So anything that, you know, that would obviously make it more pro-Reyna. And so this, I think, in the eyes of a lot of people was viewed through a lens that was, wow, that's so cool. What a, like, what a cool celebration. What a cool way to take a shot at Berhalter. I get that. But it's just, I don't know. Maybe this makes me in the pro Berhalter camp. I don't know, but that's just not that's just not how I can see it. Like,
seriously though, like I want to circle back. So when you see him volley that goal in, do you not think, what a great goal? Like, I know we've had just the weirdest month with this. It's been so, like, we couldn't have predicted the just how bad things would get after the World Cup and all this stuff would break. But I still think that's a brilliant goal from a great player. That's all I think, though. I don't associate, like, it's whatever happened. But it doesn't take any gloss off it for me.
Oh, it did for me. I'll really? Be honest. Yeah, it did for me. Like, the quality of the goal, that's unchanged. But I didn't, like, I don't know, that could have been, like, the emotion that I felt in seeing that goal scored, like, it felt to me like it could have been anybody. It could have been Rafael Guerrero who scored that goal. Like, I didn't feel like a real connection to the guy who scored it. Like, I feel like I might have before all this happened. I don't know, I'm still kind of, I don't know, I'm kind of just, like, down on him right now still.
Wow, like, I'll tell you, it just goes to show how damaging this has been when someone like you, an absolute U.S. men's national team fiend, sees that amazing goal and it's your perception of it is impacted because of what's gone on. That's bad. And that's, like, very bad.
And with the, maybe I'm alone. I might be in the minority. I'm willing to acknowledge that, but just kind of still where my head is at. And, like, with the celebration, I don't know, like, for a player who has maturity questions kind of swirling around him, is this a good look? Like, is don't you think what Gio Reyna needs right now is for people to move past this as quickly as possible? But when you do this, you are keeping it front and center.
Yeah,
that's what you're doing. I know you think in the moment what you're doing looks cool. I'm going to look so cool when I take a shot at this guy who benched me in the World Cup. I mean, I know I saw on Twitter a lot of people thought it did look cool, but you lost me with it. You just lost me. Like, if you want to convince us that your maturity being questioned is wrong, this ain't it. Like, this is not how you win people over into your side. But maybe that's not his concern. He may not care about that. I'm going to be who I am, and I'm going to be good enough that I'm going to force myself into any team that there is. You don't have to like me. I mean, maybe that's his approach right now. I don't know, but
I would just love to hear from him about what happened, what went down. Did he not sanction it, but did he agree with it? How much did he know? Was he consulted? That's the stuff I want to know from him.
But don't you think when the first thing he does when he returns to a pitch, he scores a goal, and the first thing he does is to make fun of the manager involved. Don't you think that he's answering that question? Like, you would love to know all that. To me, that answers the question. He sanctioned all of it. He was happy for all of this to get out. Like, he doesn't care that it brought him down as well. Like, I don't know. I feel like that question has been answered now. But
maybe so.
More U.S. soccer news as Brian McBride is out as the USMNT general manager. 3 years on the job. You talked about this at the start of the podcast, JJ. I always wondered, what exactly is the difference between his job and Ernie Stewart's job? Is there redundancy there, like a sporting director, a general manager? Who's doing what, especially on a team that isn't necessarily making signings? Like, do they need both these two guys doing these jobs? So The Athletic, they said this of McBride. His primary responsibilities included managing relationships between the federation and the club teams of players within the pool, and to, quote, oversee the development and management of the player pool. I don't know if that answers your question. Or if your
eyes
glazed over.
I never heard him say anything about the job. I never heard him say, you know, did he speak? Did he do one media engagement at all?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember either.
Probably, but I don't know.
So when we were at ESPN, was he ever available to talk? And he had worked with ESPN. He had done punditry and analysis. But I never remember, oh, hey, he's Brian McBride is speaking. Or like for me, after the unpleasantness, after the disaster, after US soccer's kind of review into what happened in Trinidad and Tobago, he was drafted in as kind of, how would you put it? Not a sticking plaster, but to usher in a new wave of administration. But I don't know a single policy decision. I know from the dispatches surrounding Gio Reyna and that whole incident that he was contacted by the Reynas. We know that much.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I can't tell you a single thing he did.
I agree, which is why I essentially have no opinion of this.
No.
It didn't. I mean, other than like the fact that he's a U.S. soccer legend, so he's a big name, and now he's out of the federation, like that, I guess, is a story. But in terms of what this actually means for the direction of U.S. soccer, I don't know. I really don't know.
No. And how much did his job overlap with Ernie Stewart's role?
Yeah.
I don't get it. I don't get it because I don't know.
I mean, if they're just looking for essentially like a palate cleanser to all of this, to the ugliness of what has gone on, maybe this is a sign that they're just moving on from certain figures. I wouldn't be stunned if Berhalter is the next domino to fall as that investigation continues. But yeah, I don't seeing this news, there was an initial moment of, oh, interesting. But then it was kind of like, well, my opinion is essentially unchanged of where we're at. I don't know. This moves the needle.
I immediately thought, oh, that'll mean that we don't do this or that anymore. Or maybe, but I don't know what this or that was.
Yeah.
I don't know. What was the content of his job? What was his day-to-day responsibilities?
I mean, if he was managing relations between the players in the pool and their clubs, I guess he was doing a fine job. I don't know.
I mean, that job is... Okay, that's a liaison job.
I don't know. There's that. Now, another interesting development occurred. We'll go back to the club level here. Juventus, JJ, their fall from grace continues. This time taking a serious blow after significant sanctions handed down against them. They were found guilty of transfer irregularities. They were docked 15 points. A number of figures within the club were suspended for various lengths of time. The most notable, Andrea Agnelli, suspended for 2 years, and Fabio Paratici, 2.5 years. He, of course, is no longer with the club. It only figures that Tottenham would find their way into this somehow.
Yep.
And so they have. Their director of transfers is now suspended. He'll appeal this. I don't know how long. I'm assuming he'll appeal this. I don't know how long that will last. It could last for a length of time. I don't know how Tottenham's opinion of him will be impacted by the fact that he has been implicated in this. If they would fire him, if they think actually you've done a fine job for us, so we're good to keep you on here, even with whatever this stink is that it's attached to you now for this controversy. I mean, look, we're talking. This is the guy who on the cheap went back into Juventus and brought back Bentancur and Kulusevski. So he's done fine work. I'm sure he'll be either suspended or ushered on out because certain clubs can't have nice things, JJ. And I guess this is another example, but I don't mean to make this about Tottenham. This is terrible for Juventus. So the 15 points, basically, it's interesting because initially this was supposed to be them being docked 9 points.
Right.
I was reading Gab Marcotti had a really great explainer on this at ESPN FC.
Essential.
Yeah, for anyone who's sort of like, what exactly happened here? Why is this going on? Read it. It's a must read. But essentially, they were going to be docked 9 points. Then they got hot. And then the punishment was changed to 15 points because I think the message needed to be sent that, no, you cannot be allowed to qualify for the Champions League. So we're going to change the point punishment to whatever we need it to be to get you to a place where it's increasingly unlikely that you'll be able to qualify. A 9-point deduction still would have had them potentially within arm's reach. Now it moves them down to, I think they're, 11th in the table? They're kind of now mid-table. Not going to be relegated. It's not that kind of punishment. But for a club who is in dire financial straits themselves, who is desperate for Champions League football, this is a huge blow.
It is. Agnelli left his role as the president of Juventus last week. And as he was going, he was saying how warning, correctly, I would say, of the implications of the Premier League's dominance and transfers and interest and TV money and everything on the rest of European football. And now all those things have just been kind of washed away as it's another controversy for Juventus in a history of controversies for Juventus. I mean, this is a team we know about Calciopoli and in the mid-2000s and then being relegated. I mean, it's an absolute disaster. And their losses, Andrew. Juventus posted Serie A record losses of more than 250 million last year, breaking their own record from the previous season of 210 million.
Unbelievable, yeah.
It's crazy.
How can they continue to function at that rate?
I don't know. I really don't know. And now without Champions League football, this is really, really incredible. And what they did essentially was cooking the books. So basically, engineering transfers, usually swap deals, where little or no money changed hands, but the club drew an accounting benefit on paper. So, I mean, I do not know what happens here, but I mean, Gab kind of lays it out in the piece about you know, the essentially fraudulent activity that's been alleged. It was adjudicated on before by the courts, but then they reopened it.
Right, they were cleared initially.
They were. There were them and eight other clubs: Genoa, Sampdoria, Empoli, Provincelli, Novara, Pescara, Parma, and Pisa were charged and ultimately cleared. But the prosecutors successfully agreed to reopen the case because they say new evidence emerged. So, Juventus thought they were home and hosed; they got away with it, but clearly not the case now anymore. And I mean, this could be dire for them, absolutely dire, on top of the bad situation they're in already. And you can see now why the Agnellis were so desperate to make the Super League happen and how they essentially haven't abandoned that. And I guess that's their Hail Mary, Andrew, the ongoing court case surrounding like whether the Super League can exist, whether it's something that they're allowed to go and do, whether UEFA are right to be able to control that, or that's the Hail Mary for them right now. It's absolutely incredible that we've got to this point.
Yeah, it's a really bleak picture for them, undoubtedly, especially as, you know, other clubs seem to be rising in that league, at least for the time being, Napoli at the top of the list. So yeah, it's not good right now for Juventus. Finally, JJ, to close out, it's a Monday morning. We've got the whole week ahead of us. There's a lot of soccer going on this week. I'm wondering about the things that you're most looking forward to this week.
Well, I'm looking forward to our next broadcast, as always. Being with you, Andrew, is it's the highlight of the week. We got some FA Cup action. That could be pretty good.
This Friday, it's Arsenal and Manchester City in the FA Cup.
That's got to be the one you're looking at. And
not for me.
What's that?
Not for me.
No, what are you looking forward to?
We got Carabao Cup semis.
That's
on
true.
Tuesday and Wednesday. And it's interesting because I feel like the teams involved in these semifinals, if you look at it, you've got Southampton and Newcastle on Tuesday, Nottingham Forest and Manchester United on Wednesday. You know, there's no Chelsea there. There's no Manchester City there, who have had a stranglehold on this cup competition for a generation. So I feel like we've reached four clubs who, no matter who goes on and wins this thing, it's going to be a fascinating team to be raising a trophy. Even a club like Manchester United, where, you know, you don't necessarily think that them winning a League Cup is a huge deal. But to start, you know, for the first available trophy to Erik ten Hag, for him to go out and win it, I think that would be a huge statement right out of the gate for this new project of Manchester United. And then look, obviously the other ones, I mean, Southampton might be going down. For them to get a trophy in this season would be huge for them. For, you know, Nottingham Forest, you know, they, even though their goal differential is a disaster, they've managed to rise to be a mid-table team. What an incredible achievement would be for their first season back in the Premier League to come away with a trophy. And then there's Newcastle. You know, I think a lot of us had said that this project, you know, while we knew it was going to bear fruit for them, we all feel that it's doing so quicker than imagined. And if they get a trophy right out of the gate, this early on in the project, I think, again, it would be another statement of intent that they, you know, so no matter what, no matter who goes on to win this, I think it's a fascinating champion that we're going to have. So we'll start to see how it's going to play out this week.
Yeah. And I think with Newcastle, just that was the big thing, that they haven't won a trophy in, I mean, what, a century, you know? So that's like, that's always been the thing. They came so close winning the Premier League in the mid-90s. For them to, like you said, to get off to such a flyer and have a trophy and possibly a top four finish this season would just be absolutely stunning for them.
Yeah,
maybe you're right. Maybe those semifinals are the tasty treat this week.
Interesting stuff. Yeah. So there you go. That's all I got.
That's all I got, Andrew. I'd like to congratulate you for your win the other night.
Thank you. The Eagles, I assume you're talking about?
Yeah. Well, not Tottenham, but yeah.
No, Tottenham plays later today.
Yeah, Fulham. That's right. I was hoping for an exciting game at the very least. It did not happen. But I was just so pumped for the game. And it's one of those, American football can do that to you. It was one of those games where very, very quickly you realized it's not going to be your night.
No, that almost didn't feel like a fair fight. That was a smashing. That was a beatdown. And I know we got to run. So I feel bad bringing this up now, which could be like a show unto itself. But our mutual friend JJ Peter Rosenberg, he texted me at the end of the game, and he said that it was one of those beatings to him, who a neutral fan in this. He said it was one of those beatings where he thinks the Giants would have been better off not making the playoffs at all.
I saw him. He tweeted that as well.
Yeah.
That, to me, that is, what is the point?
I wrote back to him. I said, you're wrong. I wholeheartedly disagree.
Oh, I think he's completely wrong.
If this had happened in the wild card round, then like maybe I could see it. Like, I know we've talked before, JJ, on this show about Brazil's beatdown at the hands of Germany back in 2014, that maybe Brazil would have been better off just losing normally to Colombia in the round before, rather than getting the joy of that win, but then going down and having a historic beating that will define them. Maybe they should have just lost normally in the round before. But to say, like, the Giants, they reached the playoffs in a year where they weren't supposed to, and then they won a playoff game.
Yeah.
Like, these are not small things for a team that has, and I'm not trying to talk trash about them or anything, like, literally, statistically, have been one of the three worst teams in football over the last 5 years.
Yeah.
Like, if you go and win a playoff game this year, like, it's proof that, okay, this new head coach we have, it's working. Like, but if you miss the playoffs altogether, it's just another year of wondering, like, are we going in the right direction? Like,
you know, also sports, like, you don't, the outcomes aren't guaranteed. You always walk into it with the chance of getting pummeled. That is what you accept as sports. The idea that you would forgo that just to avoid the possibility of embarrassment is crazy. It's cowardly.
And also, and you're a Giant fan. Like, how will you look back on this season?
Fantastic season.
Right. That's what I would think.
Yeah. We surprised ourselves. It was tremendously fun to beat the Vikings last Sunday.
Yeah.
Or Saturday, rather. It was tremendous fun. You know, the game against the Eagles wasn't good, but like, we know who the Eagles are now. In my view, they're favorites for the Super Bowl right now. That's my opinion.
Yeah. And look, the Giants played them earlier in week 14, and the same thing happened in MetLife. Right. The Eagles destroyed them. So that was always a possibility that there's a huge talent gap between the two teams. Like, it was always possible that this was going to be the outcome. I think Giant fans were just surprised because they had like talked themselves up into such a frenzy with how they had been playing lately, and the Eagles hadn't really been playing their best football over the last month. So I think Giant fans went into it really almost surprisingly confident. But this could all be another podcast, I suppose.
It is, but it's a great argument for sport, not just football. Like, does that kind of an embarrassment make you wish you never got there? For me, absolutely not.
Yeah, I think I agree. In this case, I definitively agree. The Brazil one, I go back and forth on.
No, I would say about Brazil, that was such a humiliation that, and I would, we must say, there is no normal way for Brazil to lose. Brazil losing in a World Cup is a disaster.
Right.
So there's no normal way to do it, but that was a humiliation beyond humiliations. It wasn't just that they lost 2-0. They collapsed. They conceded 7 goals.
Oh, that would have been a disastrous way for Panama to lose. Like that's not like
it was a humiliation on the biggest on their biggest moment of that tournament so far.
On home soil.
So yeah, that's not the same thing. Okay, we got to get out.
All right. Hey, this was fun, man. To you, I say.
Check you later, fun boy.
See ya. Have a good week.
Yeah, you too.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.